Oh, okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak and this invitation. It's very exciting to be able to talk in Canada without going there. Although it's also, of course, exciting to go there. But for us Aussies, it's actually Aussie-based mathematicians. This is great progress. I hope we'll do some more of that in years to come, that we are able to connect so easily. So I am going to give an overview over equivariant elliptic cohomology. And I apologize in advance if it's not very heavy on like giving credit and literature references and precise reading and so on. Maybe I should have put here a word gentle in front of the overview. It's supposed to be just a story to give you a picture of what the subject is even about and who's working on what. And I'm absolutely bound to forget people and like not do justice to all parts of it, because it's such a vast and diverse subject. But nonetheless, I'll give it a try, and I'll start here really with this is not a very Zoom friendly slide. I hope that you can see what's in the lower right corner, but I'm starting here with the chromatic tower. So with what is even elliptic cohomology, and I'll set it up in such a way that we're working equivariantly to start with. Partly because, of course, this is a talk on equivariant elliptic cohomology, so we're going to need this later, but mostly because the chromatic picture also becomes much clearer in the equivariant setting. So you might have seen stories involving CP infinity or CP1 here. Sorry, this is not a CP infinity, but you might have seen the story where here this circle equivariant elliptic cohomology, that's Borel equivariant elliptic cohomology. So here, this is really H of CP infinity. With complex coefficients. And well, if you're a topologist, we don't have too many topologists in the audience, I believe, but the topologists, they will complain that I don't have power series here. So that's a Borel's convention, actually, to take the sum rather than the product of these groups. So this is a polynomial ring. So what's the relevancy of CP infinity? CP infinity is the classifying space of the circle. And this slide here, it focuses on the circle group, but ultimately Tori won't be much more complicated. But I really want to get some across a simple picture of what we're even doing here. So oftentimes we see the story with Quillen's theorem and this affine one-dimensional formal group laws and so on. We see this told in the context of, formal completions, right? And so the formal completion, this B on the topological side, makes a formal completion on the algebraic side, So that's why we oftentimes see the story told with these CP infinity, because everything that is happening, so Chern classes and all these things, Chern classes are something about line bundles, right? So really there's something about U1 bundles, but then they get classified by a map to BU1 or CP infinity. So suddenly we make them something about bundles over CP infinity, And this is some other classical formulation of this Quillen theorem. So Quillen at some point proved that the big theorem, really important starting point of a lot of developments in homotopy theory many years ago, that complex genus, so a ring map from the cobordism ring. So maybe I should here comment that this mu star, this is the cobordism ring, complex manifolds. And the genus is just a ring map out of that cobordism ring. A complex genus is a ring map out of the complex cobordism ring to some other ring R. And Quillen showed that these are in one-to-one correspondence with affine one-dimensional formal group laws. So in other words, that this mu star, this cobordism ring, carries the universal such one-dimensional formal group law. Yeah? And the classical examples is that you take the additive formal group law, and that has to do with the most silliest genus that you could possibly think of, namely the counting genus. So if you have a complex manifold, the easiest ring map that you can think of out of the cobordism ring takes your manifold, and first of all, it looks whether the dimension is zero or greater than zero. If the dimension is greater than zero, it throws it away, just puts a zero there. And if the dimension is zero, then it counts the number of points in M. Yeah, so this is totally a genus taking values in the integers. It's a little bit of a boring genus, doesn't tell you like an invariant of a manifold where you needed like some powerful tool for to distinguish these manifolds. But that's the ring map, right? If I take the disjoint union of two manifolds, then those numbers add. If I take the product of two manifolds, those numbers add. And it's invariant under Borisms. Now, it happens so that this is realized by some push forward in the cohomology theory. Yeah, but let me, before I get there, let me start here with the blue columns. So it becomes more interesting when, once you take this multiplicative formal group law. And so here, this is formulated in a non-equivariant setting. So the blue part here, this is a non-equivariant statement, but on the outside, you have the equivariant analogs. Yeah? The middle part here is non-equivariant. Or in other words, the CP infinity plays a role in there. So in a way, it's equivariant. It's taking into account some U1 phenomenon. But this is kind of the classical formulation. So here we have this multiplicative formal group law. That's a power series in X and Y. Again, like just simple and finite power series, sending X and Y to X plus Y minus XY. And associated to this under the Squillen correspondence is the Todd genus, or this is also known alternatively under the name complex Euler characteristic, I think in math physics circles. Okay. And finally, some topologists, Ted, here you can see already on the outside, right? We have some topological incarnations of these. I'll get to it in a second because I want to set it up in a equivariant setting. But you can then ask, you know, there's a third natural source. So we have additive, we have multiplicative, the third one-dimensional family of algebraic groups is elliptic curves. And so here you can really even just think of this E as something like C modulo 1 tau, or if you like, the multiplicative part modulo Q to the Z. Yeah? And you can, so what does it mean taking the completion? If you're not familiar with that, you take a coordinate near zero and you expand your addition on your elliptic curve as power series in that coordinate. Yeah, so then it becomes a power series in two coordinates, describing this, approximating this addition. And so it becomes something like this, just that now we have infinitely many terms. And so what is written here is a definition. So let me say it, A genus, so A map out of the complex cobordism ring into some other ring, deserves the name elliptic. So this was here an example, but that's the most important example. We may speak about other elliptic curves or other rings. So, but here we're looking at the complex numbers. But so a genus out of the complex cobordism ring into whatever other ring deserves the name an elliptic genus. If there's an elliptic curve over my ring R, such that this formal completion around zero gives a formal group law, which under the Squillen correspondence agrees with this genus. Okay, so that's a bit of a mouthful. The word that I want to emphasize here for historical reasons is this word N. So if you look at older literature, you will see a lot of papers referring to the elliptic genus, the universal elliptic genus, and all these things. There's no such thing really as the elliptic genus. I mean, maybe if you want to speak about TMF orientation, you can argue that that's what it should be. But really, you can have an equal opportunity approach to all of these. Yeah. So you look here, rather than looking at the universal object, you just look at the stack of all of these elliptic genera. Yeah. Okay. So with these come cohomology theories. So let's maybe look. So we have here this theme that we have additive, multiplicative, elliptic. And such one-dimensional formal group laws, and that's how Quillen very much thought about this, they occur as term classes, as a rule from term classes in some cohomology theory. So if you have a cohomology theory with term classes, for instance, singular cohomology or K-theory or later elliptic cohomology, then you can ask yourself, so the term classes satisfy some axioms, but the axioms don't say anything about the tensor product of two line bundles. And you can ask yourself, you know, what happens if I take these two line bundles and I take the term class of these two line bundles? This can be expressed in terms of the term classes of L1. And L2 of these two line bundles, right? So I have a Chern class, I have one line bundle, I have another line bundle, I have take the Chern class of one line bundle, of the other line bundle, and of their product. And these are related by the formula that expresses this Chern class as a power series in these two Chern classes. And this power series is called plus over F. And that's an example of an FN one-dimensional formal group law. So really, so the way Quillen went at this was that he saw that, you know, these formal group laws, they arise naturally in cohomology theories from the story. So for instance, here, if you look at K-theory, my universal Euler class is 1 minus L for some line bundle, or for the universal line bundle over CP infinity, if you want to work non-equivariantly. And from that, you can fairly easily derive this multiplicative formal group law, yeah? This is also a well-known fact about singular cohomology. If you know Chern classes in singular cohomology, then you know that if you take the Chern class of a tensor product of two line bundles, you get just the ordinary sum back. No formal power series needed. But if you go for K-theory already, that changes. This is not the sum. And so in elliptic cohomology, again, you can say N elliptic cohomology theory. So not elliptic cohomology, like that's not like one fixed object. Any cohomology theory with Chern classes, it is said to be an elliptic cohomology theory if the formal group law here that governs the Chern classes of tensor products of line bundles is identified with the formal group law that comes from some completion of an elliptic curve. Yeah? Okay. Are there questions so far? So let's go to the equivariant picture, because this becomes a little bit more clear, this picture, additive, multiplicative, elliptic, if you go to the equivariant setting. And I mean, maybe one should say, or maybe I should say that I always found this non-equivariant picture a little bit frustrating because it seemed far-fetched. Yeah, okay, we had these two sources of one-dimensional formal group laws, and we kind of insisted to make a relationship between them. And it seemed almost a little bit artificial. Of course, interesting mathematics came out of this. But if you look at the equivariant setting, and if you look carefully here, I haven't really said whether this is equivariant or non-equivariant. So this fits into this equivariant setting. So you could have here now equivariant Chern classes. So you could think of your line bundle, for instance, as having a U1 action on there. Did I call this? I didn't call it U1 here. I called it C star. So circle equivariant for representation theorists, if you wish. So if you have a circular covariant theory, so you have a circular covariant bundle, and so instead of writing here 1 minus L over some Borel construction, I write 1 minus L just remembering that circle action. Yeah, this is the trivial line bundle. So this is certainly a construction you can make. In ordinary cohomology, we don't really have a better equivariant version than this Borel equivariant version. So here, the circle equivariant coefficients, the HC star of a point, becomes just H star of CP infinity. And it is, as I said in the beginning, this polynomial algebra. In K theory, however, we do have a refinement. We do have a genuinely equivariant theory, and this is the equivariant vector bundles, right? And equivariant vector bundles over the point is just the representation ring of the group in question, yeah. And that happens to be here for the circle group, the ring C adjoins Z, Z inverse, yeah. And it's worth maybe just to mention here that to go from equivariant in K theory here, to go from equivariant to non-equivariant or to Borel equivariant, this is a completion, right? That's due to Atiyah Siegel, this point of view. And in general, you should think of this map here, right? Completing something that you have on this side. So you have here the genuinely equivariant thing, which gives you a one-dimensional algebraic group, and the completion then gives you the Borel equivariant picture. Yeah. So here, genuinely equivariant, here Borel equivariant. The slide is getting a little bit full, so maybe maybe I'll add this here. The Borel. So here I have the completion map. And as I said before, for the singular cohomology, this is just the same thing. But for K-theory, something interesting happens. And the elliptic cohomology will be built in such a way also that you're decompleting, so to say, something that people had built in the non-equivariant setting before, yeah? But let's stick a little bit here with the K-theory and cohomology. So first of all, we've seen here that the rings are, this is the additive, this is the global sections of the structure sheaf of the additive group. It just happens so that this is affine. So, you know, this is a little bit of a far-fetched thing to say maybe in this context, but bear with me here. So the same thing for the multiplicative group, right? These are the functions on the multiplicative group. And then you know what you want to write down for elliptic cohomology. And so here suddenly it becomes important that we're speaking in a sheaf-valued thing because this is a projective. So E is my elliptic curve, for instance, this. Yeah, we're working over the complex numbers, yeah? So E is my elliptic curve, so the structure sheaf is OE, and that's what you want circle equivariant elliptic cohomology of the point to be, you know, the coefficients of the theory. And so I should say a number of things here. So first of all, this is not Hopkins or Lurie point of view. So this is a sheaf valued cohomology theory. It's a cohomology theory that decides that the target category is a category of sheaves rather than a sheaf of cohomology theory, which is a much more complicated animal, and we're not going to look at that today. Yeah, so this is a much more low-tech approach here to build this sheaf of cohomology, sheaf-valued cohomology theory. You can just say, look, what is a cohomology theory? You have a bunch of axioms, you want long exact sequences and so on. So we might just let that take values in our favorite abelian category. It doesn't necessarily need to be rings, yeah, or groups. Now, the second thing that I want to draw your attention to is also, here, could I just take global sections? Well, maybe not so much because the global sections are boring, right? They're just the constants. Maybe if I start to add a grading here and like add all sorts of different gradings, and I get line bundles over my elliptic curve, and then I could take the global sections of the entire graded ring, and that might be more interesting. In fact, it will be more interesting because the relevant line bundles are ample. But let's stick with the way this is set up. And traditionally, that we're speaking here about the cohomology theory. So here, you could switch back and forth because these are affine varieties. We can switch back and forth between speaking about coherent sheaves on these varieties or just the modules over the relevant rings. So the classical theory can be reformulated, and maybe it's worth to say has been reformulated already, going back to Borel, yeah, into a sheaf value theory. And you can ask yourself what are the stalks and all these things, and it has been studied. But for elliptic cohomology, somehow it becomes more essential. Like, you can't really do much without that language. Yeah, for the other theories, maybe if you're kind of don't like sheaves, or for whatever reason you don't care about that picture, you can get away with ignoring that, but not for elliptic cohomology. Yeah. Now, what is the second line here about? That's about your term classes, right? So if you look here, what's the term class, the first term class of the universal line bundle? Here, that's called the Euler class. That's what this is. So that's your X, that X. Yeah, so the ideal generated by that X is X times CX. Yeah, and this has to do with the fact that this is a principal ideal. So this is the ideal of X is a coordinate around zero. That's not a coincidence. Yeah, so this is the ideal sheaf of zero. And this is a principal ideal, and that has to do with the Thom isomorphism, something being free of rank one over something else. Yeah. Now, what about K-theory? So in K-theory here, I have this Chern class, universal Chern class, that's written 1 minus L. And this is no longer over CP infinity. I can interpret this as something over CP infinity. It's written here deliberately ambiguously. But I can also interpret this as just something in here, right? So L, being the thing that I renamed Z here just to make it look like the multiplicative group. But this is really... L is the fundamental representation of the circle group. The circle group is C star, it acts on C in the obvious way. And so here I have 1 minus C, right? Where on C, my circle acts with weight 1, yeah? So I've named this two different things on this slide. On the right-hand side, it's called Z, and on the left-hand side, it's called L. But it's a one-dimensional representation of the circle group. So it's just a complex number with an ordinary circle action. And now my Euler class becomes 1, which is just a trivial bundle over the point here, minus C1, which is the circle bundle, the circle representation of dimension 1 with weight 1. And in here, this becomes 1 minus Z. So this is again a coordinate around, well, 0, but 0 is called 1 in the multiplicative group. Yeah, it's a coordinate around the unit. So again, this is a principal ideal that I get here. So again, I have a Thom isomorphism, is what's in the background here. This is free of rank 1 over this. And this ideal, you can see here a pattern, the ideal of 0 and the additive group, the ideal of 1 and the multiplicative group. On the elliptic curve, it turns out that the role of these Euler classes is slightly different. What is the reason here? This is not free, right? This is a line bundle, so it's locally free and of rank 1. Can you see what I'm writing here? For my zoom, oftentimes there's something covering that corner. But okay, so this ideal sheaf in the elliptic case is locally free of rank 1. So there's not really something that quite plays the role of these generators, right? You can't generate this as a principal ideal. However, ultimately, in all our computations, what we need these for is really to translate sections of this into just functions. And there is something that people who work with elliptic curves use to do exactly that, which is these theta functions. So the role of these generators here is played by the theta function here. Yeah. So it doesn't have the same nature as these, but it has the same purpose, if you wish. Okay. So this is enough, I think, on the first slide. We're halfway through the talk, but this is the fullest slide. So I'm going to have a look here at how this plays out, how you actually calculated anything here. So I think one more thing to say is here that, okay, our elliptic curve, I've already said, is the complex elliptic curve. So tau is the upper half plane, q is e to the 2 pi I tau. And then we also have the scenario. So this was here for the circle. This is the base that everything works over. But I was saying, okay, we also would like to speak about tori, and then we just need to take the elliptic curve times itself, however many times we need to, namely the rank of the torus. And the coordinate free way to write this is that we take the covariate lattice and we tensor with our elliptic curve. And then T equivariant elliptic homology is the functor from T spaces to the quasi coherent sheaves on this space. Okay. And the theory is, if you wish, reverse engineered from the stalks. And I should say that this goes back to Gronowski. Yeah, so all of these ideas come from Gronowski. But the picture, the underlying picture is fairly simple. So let's say I have here my Thom space of the bundle C lambda. So if I have over the point, I have the bundle, which is the one-dimensional line bundle, and on there acts my torus with weight lambda. That gives me a sphere, a two-dimensional sphere, if I'm a topologist. Yeah, so this is a complex one-dimensional orbit. And it's somehow a philosophy that people in representation theory, geometric representation theory, have, is that they like spaces where the one-dimensional orbits give you all the information that you want about your space. Yeah? And so if you want to understand how you should be able to calculate such a one-dimensional orbit, well, you need, if you have any kind of self-respecting cohomology theory, it better satisfy Meyer Viator. So here's a picture of my one-dimensional orbit. It has two fixed points. And then in between, we have the sphere on which lambda acts. And symbolically, we draw this as the two fixed points here, and an arrow with this lambda telling me which direction lambda is moving. So one of them is zero, and the other one is infinity. These two fixed points. Color code this. Yeah, so that gives me my orientation of that arrow. And this is going, the slogan here is this moment graph story. So the moment graph toolkit, if you don't know it, it's a way to just organize your space. So many nice spaces, for instance, flat varieties, scribble varieties, and so on. You can really study their K-theory or their cohomology, or it turns out their elliptic cohomology, by understanding just the graph of the fixed points, which is a handful of points, like it's a discrete set, and the one-dimensional orbits. And so you end up drawing graphs which have the fixed points in there and then lines for each one-dimensional orbit, like so, yeah? And you impose a condition on this, or like the cohomology of this thing injects into the cohomology of the fixed points, the direct sum of the just coefficients of these two points, and the coefficients that's just the structure sheaf of the thing. So we know what the points give us. So we take two copies of the structure sheaf here, yeah? And now inside here sits LT of this whole thing, yeah? So it this equalizer of two such maps. So what are these two such maps? They have to do with the one-dimensional orbit, right? So if you look at the Mayer-Villetaurus sequence, you can easily cut this, say, along the equator, or like if you wish, you take out this point, it's contractible, you take out that point, it's contractible, and then the intersection is just a copy of your circle, right? So you can make like a, because I've chosen my circle to be C star, I can make my equator bigger for it to just be C star, and C star, of course, is, so if I take this P1 lambda, maybe right up here, and I take out my two fixed points, then that's a copy of C star, but of course, I would like to think of this equivariantly, and so that's just C star and Tx by lambda, but I can write here, the short exact sequence, saying this is an orbit, right? So T surjects onto this, and the kernel I call K lambda, yeah? And if you have a decent change of group behavior, then this just tells you that the K-theory of this thing should be the K-lambda equivariant K-theory or elliptic homology of a point, yeah? So on the equator, we have my theory elliptic homology of T mod K lambda, and this should be the same thing as elliptic homology K lambda equivariant of a point. And again, we know what that is, right? So my Mayer-Villetaurus relates these two points where we know what it is, namely structure sheaf of ET, to this one-dimensional orbit, where again, we can reduce this to something of a point, but now with a different group, namely this kernel. And so we know again what we have here and what these restriction maps are. Yeah. And my elliptic cohomology of this projective space is just identified as the equalizer of these two maps. Yeah. So the description that people normally use to work with is that it's pairs A and B in here, such that the difference lies in the ideal sheaf of this base associated to the smaller group, yeah? And instead of speaking about a sheaf-valued theory, you can also sort of formulate this as a scheme-valued theory, and then you get some of all the arrows turned around, we get a co-equalizer here, yeah? That's sometimes useful. And so this circle of ideas is really the technical heart, how it is used, how these things are used to study nice enough objects. Yeah, so equivariantly formal is the word here. And this is, again, something that's been done for cohomology by Goreski, Kotwitz, McPherson. They started a whole industry of people doing this moment graph theory, and then for K-theory, I think it was Ioanni Doroșu and Alan Knudsen who set this up. And they also did elliptic homology, but somehow it's hidden away in some remark in the appendix in the paper that's on K-theory. And then Ioanni quit math, so nobody ever knows about this result. But it is a result that's just poorly advertised. Yeah. Okay, so I've already mentioned this earlier, that some of the key new features that these ideal sheaves are no longer trivial. So we need to somehow change our language to accommodate for that. Yeah, in the additive and the multiplicative case, they were trivial, but here they're just locally free of rank. Yeah, so free of rank one should make you think tome isomorphism. And so instead of tome isomorphism, now we have a tome sheaf, being a line bundle, yeah? On what line bundle? On ET, yeah, on the base over which all our sheaf value theory lives. Okay. And already I said this in the beginning slide, but here I'm just expanding this a little bit. The role of Euler class, which in HNK was trivializing section, is now played by the theta function. And the theta function is actually this theta function that we're speaking about, the basic theta function. Or sometimes you have, oh yeah, here we have the circle. Theta function, so z is, remember, z was the one-dimensional fundamental representation of the circle. And so here we have the torus. And lambda is a weight. Actually, let me write this here as lambda plus weight, not co-weight. Yeah. Okay, so writing lambda there in the exponent gives me a function from the core character lattice to the circle. And lambda itself is a function from the weight lattice to the circle. So we have this convention that we write character and co-character lattice multiplicatively and weight and co-weight lattice additively, which is consistent with what the representation theorists do, but not consistent with what the topologists like to do. So it's a little bit of a mismatch here of terminologies. I would like to sort of really, really emphasize here the substantial body of unwritten work due to Gronowski, and I always have the feeling that, like, when I write something on the subject, that Gronowski kind of knew this. And some sort of ideas also by Hopkins, by Siegel, and so on. But there's work that's also written, first of all, by Roshu. This is the person who quit after his PhD, so we don't, like, we're only slowly starting to really appreciate his work and, like, use it and stuff and so on, because he just wasn't around to tell us about it on conferences for much longer. But Matthew Endo has picked this up, Jack Morava, I have written a little bit about this too. Yeah. Now, how are these different theories related and what are the new developments? So first of all, let's think about the new geometric construction. So this is one of the two really big developments in the field, is that a number of people, and somewhat independently, came and they suddenly had, like, after all these years since the 80s, really in the 80s, Siegel was asking, you know, what is an elliptic object? And people have thought about it long and hard, and really intelligent people have thought about it deeply for 10, 20 years and built a lot of understanding. So of course here Stolz and Teichner are the people who created a whole big framework for us, how we even attempt to think about this. And everybody who works on this has in some way been inspired by Stolz and Teichner. But for this equivariant setting over the complex number, but that is still quite interesting. Yeah. So it's far from TMF, but it's still a very interesting picture to have suddenly geometric influences. And these are all physics inspired. Yeah. So Berbig-Evans and Tripathy are maybe in spirit closest to Stolz and Teichner, which is maybe the picture that's been best disseminated because it's been around for longer. Then there's Nitu Kiçlu. Nitu Kiçlu had this dominant K theory. Yeah. And so he has some way of defining loop group equivariant K theory of loopy kind of things. Yeah. And he has this incredibly small quantum inspired theory where he somehow he ends up really writing down a theory where he takes the invariance of that thing and he ends up writing down the sheaf valued theory. And he asks, you know, at the time, I think that was 4 or 5 years ago, he was saying, I can write down this theory. It comes naturally from my K theory of the loop groups, the dominant K theory. And it's a sheaf valued theory and it looks formally a lot like Gronowski's, right? So this is Gronowski's theory here, but he could not tell, you know, the relationship between these two. So this has since been done by my PhD student, Matthew Spong. He has a comparison theorem saying indeed, whatever Nitu Kiçlu here creates is the same as what Gronowski has. And Charles Resk had a similar approach, but he went one step down the chromatic ladder, and you see here, if you have elliptic cohomology and you go one step down the ladder, you need to throw in loops, yeah? And if you go two steps down the ladder, you need to throw in double loops, yeah? So in other words, so Charles was here using double loops of the group G, double loops of the flag variety, and then needs to take invariance under a bigger group. And he didn't quite get there, so he could do it on coefficients, but not the whole theory, but then now joined with Spong, that was actually carried out and completed. So this theory also exists, and all these three theories are equivalent. Yeah. So this is what we call a transchromatic phenomenon. So if you think about this from the point of view of affine representation theory, if you're looking at just because you know you learned singular cohomology when you're in graduate student, and then you stop looking at cohomology theory, so it's your favorite theory, but then you end up looking at double loop spaces. Yeah, and turns out that K theory eats one of these loops. So you can look at just the loop space of the flag variety. And elliptic cohomology, again, here, this is elliptic cohomology of the compact flag variety and compares to K theory of the loop, like the infinite Grassmannian here. Yeah, or something closely related to the infinite Grassmannian. So here the space is a much, much, much more complicated object that you need to consider. You need to consider kind of loop groups. There's infinite dimensional analysis to worry about. And there's all sorts of technicalities that go into studying loop groups and loop phenomena. And so if you want, of course, so if you're an affine representation theorist, you might not actually study loop groups. You look at the Lie algebras and it becomes better. But if you want the geometric counterpart of that, or sort of geometric in the spirit of geometric representation theory, the theory that really offers itself is elliptic cohomology, because all that's loopy is eaten by the theory. Why? Because that's the nature of how our Euler classes look. The Euler classes in that theory are such expressions that we would normally get, right? So normally you would think of such an expression as an Euler class of some, in K theory, of something with loops, and the Q would be some kind of loop parameter. But here in elliptic cohomology, all of this sits inside the Euler class. And it's not just a matter of Euler classes and formulas, and you could say, okay, your elliptic cohomology was artificially built somehow to capture these phenomena, and you've just hidden all the technicality in the construction of your theory. But that's not quite what's going on, because the theories are actually as theories the same as my K theory of the loop groups. Yeah? Finally, there's a story by Juan and Resk building on work of Devoto and myself, which is influenced by Oberfold loop spaces a la Witten. And we don't quite know yet how that theory fits in here. It has the correct kind of behavior and twists and so on, but it's also a little bit of a different story. Yeah? So Jen Huan was a student of Charles Resk, and I think she's now based in Guangzhou, but in Germany, in Göttingen. Now, when I told Pavel Ettinghoff about this picture that Matthew had kind of proudly completed in his thesis, I stole this from him, he said, oh yeah, I wrote a book. I wrote a book with this picture on the title. So if you look at this, there's this book, yeah? And this is one of these remarkable things that, you know, this is nothing to do with elliptic cohomology, topology, loop groups, or any such thing you would think, but that picture here is clearly the same picture as what was here, yeah? And so this is one of the sort of tantalizing connections that you see from elliptic cohomology. It's a very typical feature of the subject, is about that you tell somebody about it and they have a connection, anything, whatever favorite object they have that has elliptic somehow in the name, or some kind of story of additive, multiplicative, elliptic, in the end, oftentimes has a home in this elliptic cohomology. And slowly, as this material is getting more accessible and more literature is available, people from different disciplines have started to pick that up. Yeah. So one important thing that you want to do if you're, say, a geometric representation theorist or any kind of other person wanting to deal with this stuff is that you would like to have some kind of push-pull formalism. Yeah. So for instance, one thing that I've looked at in the past, but again, this is, I think this is in the K category of things that Gronowski probably knew is that the vial character formula is a push forward along the map from the flag variety to the point in K-theory. And that same picture, so you have the compact flag variety and you push forward to the point, but now instead of applying K-theory, you apply elliptic cohomology, that already gives you the Weyl-Katz formula, yeah? And so if people have looked at this in the past, but really, I mean, what you want to do is Schubert calculus here. So you really want to understand the whole push-pull formalism along the different kind of partial flag varieties. You want to also maybe understand Schubert basis and how to multiply objects in your Schubert basis. And so the part of this you can already do, and Zhao Zhong wrote an important paper a few years ago. You can see this is getting more contemporary. These were somewhat older. So they really realized this Ginzburg-Hafanoff-Husserl program in the Hopkins-Lurie setting, and they have a push-pull formalism involving theta functions, which is wonderful. So this is much more high-tech than what I've looked at. I've looked at this Gronowski setting, which is over the complex numbers. Here, Zhao Zhong, they make some much more sophisticated homotopy theoretic push, but in principle, the basic storyline in the background is similar, and the formulas that come out are similar. But what is somehow missing here in this whole push-pull setting is Schubert classes can be singular, like Schubert cells can be singular, right? So this push-pull formalism a priori doesn't allow singular picture to start with. So this was one of the questions that really people were thinking about quite a bit over the last few years, or maybe not thinking about because they didn't really know how to think about this. We thought about it a little bit, but gave up. It's really how to define, well, maybe we didn't quite give up, but we didn't get anywhere. how to define this Schubert classes, right? If you want to do Schubert calculus, you need something to calculate with. And of course, what you can do is that you can approximate your Schubert classes with some desingularization. But so this Bott-Samuelson resolutions, but in K-theory and cohomology, you can get away with that because two different such resolutions give you the same classes. But in elliptic cohomology, this annoying feature where you have like different resolutions will give you different classes. So you need some kind of correction factor in there. And now I'm going to go straight here because I've been telling you about this. So one of the sort of really, really exciting, very recent developments last year, Richard Rimani and Andrei Weber have been able to do this, and they do it in a similar way that, and of course Kumar also, and they do it in a similar way that Borisov and Lipkober in the sort of 20 years ago or so, not quite, defined the elliptic genera of singular varieties. Yeah, so you choose some resolution of singular varieties and you define an elliptic class of that resolution, and you have some correction factor in there depending on an exceptional divisor. And then you prove that that thing is independent of choices. And that actually goes through, yeah? The only trouble that they run into is that there's some condition on singularities that Borisov and Lipkober ask, yeah? So that's something like you don't divide by zero, basically. And that's not actually true, yeah? This is simply not satisfied by the Schubert cells that you're really, the Schubert varieties that you're really interested in. And so there's a need to introduce some additional parameter to kind of accommodate this phenomenon. And this is what they call a dynamical parameter. And this dynamical parameter also turns up in the work of Aganagi Kunkov. Yeah. So what is that? They have looked at the Knitschny-Samolochnikov equations and the quantum Knitschny-Samolochnikov equations, and they sort of have a different approach. They say, okay, instead of looking, so first of all, they don't quite look at the flag variety, they look at T star of GB, and now the torus is a bit bigger, which is indicated here Bolt T. And they only look at type A, whereas here Remani, Kumar, Weber look at all types. But here the philosophy is that these stable envelopes, they kind of mimic what you want out of the Schubert basis, but on the level of the theory. So they don't bother with like having this really these geometric constructions. They look at some kind of axiomatic framework, saying where should they be supported and so on. And studying these very much in terms of fixed point in this moment graph picture that was on the sort of very early slide. And they formulate this before the slide that I just skipped ahead to. They formulate what is the stable envelope basis in the elliptic case, at least in type A. And they are able to apply this to Q difference equations. And they really have a formalism here that not just gives you the elliptic sort of analog of stories that were told in K-theory and cohomology, it also in the K-theory limits. This thing here has a limit construction that gives you back K-theory and that greatly clarifies the K-theory picture. Yeah? And again, sort of, or not again, they too, but in first, I guess, I have to introduce this dynamical parameter. It's just another parameter that turns up in the context of these integrable systems. And so instead of having this base, remember ET was given by lambda check tensor E tau. And now in addition, we have another, just pick X. X is nice enough, but this is also a lattice. Yeah. So our base becomes bigger, and there's not just a Z. So in these kind of calculations here, we have a Z in there, and now suddenly there's another parameter. Yeah. And there's an H bar parameter, but that's a smaller adjustment. And also worth mentioning in this context is that there's a difference team here, Felder, Tarasov, Rachenko, who also collaborate sometimes with Remani and others, who have their own approach to this elliptic stable envelope. And then there's Kono and Smirnov, student of Okunkov and so on. So there's a whole lot of sort of applications that are coming out of this theory, which somehow blew topologists away a little bit because it's really being picked up by a completely different crowd, right? So this is not the classical elliptic cohomology crowd. Neither are these guys, but suddenly they turn up and they use elliptic cohomology and they do things with it that we do not recognize anymore, the theories that we used to. And it's very exciting that this is happening, and more so also that this is happening simultaneously with these geometric developments, right? So not only do we have now Schubert classes and this applications to stable envelopes, also we're starting to have a fairly clear picture of what is the geometry of this theory. So traditionally, this thing here was constructed, right? I had the slide where I tell you how to compute things. This is enough to force the definition, basically. Yeah. So if you understand how these orbits behave and how the stalks behave, that gives you a definition of this LT. And that's what I say here, it's reverse engineered from the stalks. Yeah. So there's no geometric construction. So I think Gronowski had in mind also some double loop space picture and so on, but that was not written in the early 90s when he wrote this. So now others have come with double loop spaces, whether it's what Gronowski had in mind or not, I don't know. But there's this big picture now emerging with this transchromatic phenomena. And of course, you would maybe want to understand the push-pull formalism here. What is that geometrically, right? What are you doing when you're pushing and pulling? So here you have the index theorems in the K-theory setting. What do you have here, for instance? And so there's all sorts of questions that are now within reach that should maybe connect also with these applications that we have, the elliptic stable envelope, the push-pull formalism in sort of elliptic representation theory, if you wish, which is sort of Zhao Zhong, Yaping Yang is probably here also interesting person here. not quite part of this this particular work that I'm citing here, but also a collaborator of these two. And Aganage Chokunko, Farchenko Tarasov, Felder, and Rimani Kumaniveva. Okay, I think I'm out of time, so I'm going to stop here. I think that was also, I'm out of time and out of slides.
Thank you.
Yes, so is, are there questions?
There are questions for Nora.
This is a little bit random, but do you understand the connection between the K-theory Schubert basis and the stable envelopes in K-theory? Does that match up correctly?
So
no, you don't know, and no, they don't match up.
So yeah, I don't think they match up the way you would quite want it to. Sorry, I'm just gonna stop sharing the content here if I can. So it doesn't match up exactly with that basis, but if you ask people like, so Paul and Justine is sort of on our team with these things, and we have plans to really do the work that he's done with Knudsen in the elliptic setting. And if you look at this, really they use the stable envelopes. So secretly in these calculations, the stable envelopes are actually the right thing to look at, I am told, right? So I'm not an expert on this. But so yes, in K-theory, these will not be the same, I think, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask you to make speculate about kind of the most exciting things on the horizon? Like, are the exciting things pushing computation? Are the exciting things pushing the conceptual picture?
So I think that the geometric interpretations and sort of understanding them still better are exciting. I was quite excited to see this new work last year by Kumar, Rimani, and Weber. I thought that was a good connection. We have some more in Melbourne right now. We have Gufang Zhao and Yaping Yang and Paulson Justine and Arun Ram and me. So we have like heaps of people, like somewhat coincidentally, heaps of people who are working on this stuff. So we are looking a little bit into really doing Schubert calculus, like really calculating some stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I think Okunkov has a big program again. I don't understand the details of Okunkov's program, but he has a big program surrounding these elliptic integrable systems based around elliptic homology. So to me, I think what makes it exciting right now is just, it's maybe a bit of a meta statement, but seeing these communities come together and starting to speak to each other and importing, cross-importing tools from one community into the other. So that's been exciting, and there's some points that I'm somewhat mystified by. Yeah. So for instance, this dynamical parameter, like it seems to keep turning up for these people. Like different communities keep coming back with this dynamical parameter. What exactly it is to a topologist and where it fits with all these things, I don't know. Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, one of the things, so it's just like now we have sort of made these connections. So I'm not sure if that's really got across, but if I had given you a similar talk 5 years ago, there would have been a lot of sort of speculation connections. Yeah. But now there's theorems saying this thing is the same as that thing. And people actually prove stuff and they write stuff and they publish stuff and so on. Yeah. So it's less of a dreamy setting. So we have made these connections, but they're still clunky, right? it feels like you want to dive much, 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 much deeper. So for instance, one of the things that I keep trying to get my students to look at is Witten's rigidity theorem. There's Witten's original proof, and then the topologists have proofs using this sheaf-valued formalism. And it's completely different to Witten's original proof. But now you have, we have like a chain of links from one picture to the other picture that translate firmly. So can you actually import Witten's original proof into the formalism that we have in a geometric setting such that the mathematical gaps in there get rigidified in some way? Yeah. So these are sort of little things that I'm curious about. There's no sort of big overarching vision that I have other than lots of stuff is happening. But it seems like a lot of these things we've kind of just managed to, you know, stretch out our arms and the fingertips touch, and we've just grabbed our hands, so now we need to actually climb up the mountain. Yeah, so there's heaps of things to do, in other words, and I think there's a lot of things where the dust will still settle and a simpler picture will still emerge. So some of the newer things are quite technical. Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm personally also like the question that I think was Ben who asked, so whoever asked the question about the Schubert basis, I didn't see because Zoom had the screen share. That is also an interesting question, I find, like how all these different bases really relate to each other and why. So,
can I ask, how much of this is like sort of computed or even defined with like positive characteristic coefficients, so where your elliptic curve of say, or a finite field?
Yeah, so here you're asking about TMF. Yeah, so I think, so David Geffner would be the person to ask who's done some of this, and the Zhao Zhong picture that I mentioned in the end was, didn't need complex numbers, but not much has been done, but that doesn't mean not much can be done. It's simply that we were a little bit lazy or like focused, I think, on getting out a simple picture, right? So we wanted to have something kind of just the storyline there and like something very simple to do. So we didn't go for like the most high-tech setting that you could go for. But I believe that this paper by Zhao and Zhong has matured to a point where it's actually quite readable. And sorry, I didn't have a literature list in this thing, so I can make one if people are interested. But yeah, so I think people have started to really set up the framework for that, but explicit calculations are still missing. Yeah, so if you want to go and calculate, go for it. Yeah, I think it's doable. It's just, it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Thanks.
Any other questions? If not, then we should thank Nora for another excellent talk. And good morning, Nora, and good evening, everybody else.